Well, good morning, or afternoon, or wherever it is, where you are. Lectionary at Lunch, Gospel reading for Easter Sunday is Mark chapter 16, first eight verses, or depending on how you look at it, the only eight verses. I guess before we jump in, I should address briefly the text critical issues with the lectionary. First off, it should be noted that the lectionary system, in fact, does end at verse 8, as it had with Lutheran worship, and prior to that even with TLH back in 1941. And I haven't looked back further, but at least prior or since 1941, the longer ending of Mark is not part of the gospel reading for Easter Sunday. In a sense, it doesn't matter because the resurrection account is, in fact, verses 1 through 8. You don't really need the post-resurrection appearances anyway. Those would typically follow later on in the festival season. What it does impact significantly is the interpretation of these eight verses and how it suits the ending of the narrative of the Gospel of Mark. So without delving into the text critical issues here, and you can do that if you like, I'll simply state up front that I'm fairly convinced, actually completely convinced, that verses 9 through 20 were not written by Mark, that they have not been accidentally lost, as some would like to claim, that after verse 8 the last page got lost or something like that. Rather, that Mark, the author of the gospel, actually intended the narrative to end at verse 8, and that theologically there's great significance in ending it at that point, and it fits very well with Mark's themes, which I'll talk about in a minute here. So on to the text. A few sort of interesting features in the grammar here. One thing you got to get used to with Mark, as you've probably heard in some lectionary at lunch recordings already, Mark is a little bit, maybe sloppy is the word, with his prepositions. So we'll see a little bit of that in here. And another feature of Mark that we'll see quite a bit is his backgrounding and frontgrounding using verb tenses. So as we've seen numerous times in Mark already, the pericope will typically begin with an aorist, move into a primary tense indicative, present or imperfect, for the main action of the pericope, and then close out with another aorist at the end. And you see that here. So in 16 verse 1, Kai diagonomenu tu sabatu Maria he Magdalene, Kai Maria he tu Jacobu, Kai Salome, Egorison aramata, Hina elthusai aleipsosin autan. First thing, you see the diagonomenu tu sabatu, the genitive participle aorist diagonomenu from diagonomai. Here, what we call a genitive absolute, ablative absolute, I'm doing Latin or something here, genitive absolute. And you recognize the genitive absolute by having an arthrous genitive participle, that is, without the article, a noun in the genitive with the article, matching in case and number, of course, and typically at the beginning of a sentence, so not always, and always used absolutely, that is, it is independent of the rest of the sentence. So independent of the rest of the sentence means you can translate the sentence and it will work without the prepositional phrase. So diagonomai means to complete, and in the aorist tense that will give us a temporal aspect of time beforehand. So after the Sabbath was completed, so it's just giving you a time element here, then the subjects of the sentence, Mary Magdalene, or Mary the Magdalene, is actually how that should be, Mary from Magdala. And Mary, hey to Yahobu. Now, hey there is the article standing in place of hey mater, which is assumed. And the article to, which is in brackets, is uncertain. But to there represents a typical idiom for mother of. So Mary, the mother of James, is how that would be translated. The third individual is Salome. So three women, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome. Egorison, aorist, purchased. Aromata, spice says, in order that, here's your hina with aleipsosin, in order that elthusai is a kind of a confusing form. It looks like an aorist infinitive with a psi ending on there. In fact, this is a aorist participle. Elthus is the stem, and the I there is the nominative plural feminine ending. So the referent, of course, is Mary Magdalene, Mary of James, and Salome. So in order that the women having gone out, is the referent of the participle, might anoint, aleipsosin is the aorist subjunctive because of the henna from alepho, in order that they might anoint him. Now, a couple of notes here. First, the after the Sabbath was completed would be a reference to Saturday night. The Sabbath, of course, going from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. So once the Sabbath is completed, they can resume their shopping experience and head out to Walmart and pick up their spices. What's more important theologically is they're buying spices because they're going to anoint him, Jesus, that is, because they are expecting a dead body. And this is pretty critical. In the previous, at the end of chapter 15, you see there that Mary Magdalene watched where they put him. They're the last ones who haven't fled yet from Jesus. And it seems like, you know, and the women are portrayed very positively in the Gospel of Mark. So it seems like, you know, as we get to the end, the women are the ones who succeed in contrast to the disciples, but right away, they didn't get it either. See, they're expecting to find a dead body. They're buying spices to anoint a dead body. They didn't understand the resurrection of Jesus any more than the disciples did. So you have, in the end here, complete failure on the part of every human character in the Gospel of Mark to understand Jesus and what it means to be Son of God. So they bought their spices. Verse 2, now they got to get to the tomb. Kai le'an proi te mia ton sabaton, erkantai epitom nemeon, anatelantas tu eliu. Le'an proi, you got two adverbs right in a row there, kind of unusual, but something like exceedingly early, very early. Te mia, dative of time when, on the, and this is unusual, mia is a cardinal numeral, that is, you translate it as one, not the ordinal numeral protos. So it looks like it should be translated on the one of the Sabbaths. But again, here we have an idiom. On the first of the week is how you have to translate that. And mia is the adjective. The hemera is the noun that's assumed but not expressed. So exceedingly early on the first day of the week, they come. Now the action starts. Present tense, to the tomb, and here we have another genitive absolute here at the end of the sentence. Anatelantos, aorist participle from anatello, to heliu, there's your genitive noun with the article. Again, it's used absolutely. Genitive gives you previous time, so after the rising of the sun. So now they bought their spices, they went to bed, they get up very early. And it's interesting the way Mark describes this. It's sort of fuzzy. You know, you almost get a sense of fog, and it's sort of that gray time when there's not really enough light for color, you know, that sort of thing. It's a murky time, and I think it, you know, if you're going to stage a movie, this would be, you know, smoke and, you know, dusk and all kinds of, you know, it'd be a creepy kind of time here. Uncertainty lurking in the air sort of a thing. And that's continued with verse 3. Kai elegon pros haotas. Elegon, the imperfect tense. They kept on saying, probably here, to one another, or to each other. Pros haotas. Now the direct statement. Tis apokulise hemin ton lithon ek tes thuras tu mnemeu. They kept on saying to themselves, or to each other, who apokulise, from apokulio, who will roll away hemin, dative of advantage, for us, the stone from the door of the tomb. See, again, they're expecting to find a dead body in a tomb with the stone closed up. Sort of odd that they wouldn't have thought of this earlier. They're only thinking of it as they're on their way. But again, it indicates the uncertainty that the women have. They're not really sure what's going on. And it's just shown by somewhat of their confusion in all this. So verse 4 then breaks into this confusion. Kai ana blepsasaitha rusin hati apokakulistai holothos eingar megas sphodra. And on a blepo there, another aorist infinitive feminine participle, I'm sorry, aorist participle, feminine, nominative plural. And looking up, they see that apokekulistai is the perfect of apokulio, that the stone, perfect tense giving us a stative here, is in a state of roll-awayedness, I guess you'd say. So it's been rolled away, and it's still rolled away, and it's not going to roll back, I suppose you'd say. And then one of these little Markan tags, Ein gar megas sphodra. Ein gar is often used in Mark as a sort of, you know, aside sort of a thing. For it was really big, or was exceedingly big, because it was exceedingly big. Now, that's actually answering the question that the women are asking. And if you look in your apparatus, Codex Bateson and some of the Latin tradition move the sentence around to have it make more sense. But again, it's highlighting the inbreaking of something unusual thrown here at the end. The stone is rolled away, and you should take notice of this because it's unusual. This didn't happen by accident. This is a way to highlight the, it's a miraculous nature of what has occurred that the women have not been expecting. All right, so verse 5. Kai aisalthusai eston menemeon edon nianiskan kathemenon entois dexiois peribablemenon stolein lukein. Kai exathon betheson. Great word. So another feminine participle. And entering into the tomb, you see the ice there, ice on the participle, ice with the preposition. Upon entering into the tomb, they saw a young man seated, entois dixiois, the location here, at the right. Peribablemenon, another perfect from periballo here, perfect middle. So this is wearing, clothed, in a stolein lukein. Now, and they were terrified, exathon betheson. Here's an aorist indicative used as a stative. Now, in Mark's account, it's just a young man who's sitting there. And, you know, no mention of angeloi like you have in Matthew. However, if you've read the narrative of Mark, you would recognize that a stolein lukein is not a normal garment. In fact, the only other person wearing a white garment in the Gospel of Mark is Jesus himself at his transfiguration. And there, at the transfiguration, his garment is described as a gleaming white, whiter than any bleacher upon the earth can bleach it, or something like that is what it says. So while Jesus' glory is reflected by an exceedingly white garment, the young man having a white garment indicates his unearthly origin. So if you want to translate it angel, that's kind of not what it says, but that's what the young man is. He's an unearthly being, and that's signified by the white garment. And that's why the women are terrified. Otherwise, why would you be terrified at a young man sitting there? So what does the young man say? Hodelegeautais, to them, dative feminine plural. Me ekthambaisla. I love these. Stop being afraid, as if it's easy to just stop being afraid. But why? Why should they not fear? Yesun zeteta ton nazarenon, ton estaromenon, egerthe ukestin hada, ida hetapas, hapu efekan auton. Zeteta could actually be, based on the form, it'd be identical as an imperative or an indicative. It's either seek Jesus the Nazarene, or as the indicative, you are seeking Jesus the Nazarene. Here in the context, it really only makes sense to translate it as an indicative. You are seeking Jesus the Nazarene. And again, it's an indication that this young man is a unearthly being. He knows why the women are there. So Jesus here has two descriptions. Notice it's just Jesus. It's not Christos here. It's just Jesus, the Nazarene. And the second description of him is that he is ton estaromenon. Estaromenon there is, it's sort of an unusual form. It's the perfect of starao. You only recognize it as a perfect. The epsilon there is not an augment, as in the aorist, but reduplication. And the omega tells you that it's a perfect, not an aorist anyway. So you are seeking Jesus the Nazarene, the one who is in a state of crucifiedness or something, the one who has been and still is crucified. That is, he actually died. Now, this description, I think, is really significant theologically. First of all, Jesus is the Nazarene, right? The same guy that went into the tomb is the same guy that comes out. And this harkens back to chapter 1, where Jesus is described as the one from Nazareth, that you actually have a human being who, of course, as Son of God, who dies, and the same guy comes out again. And he was and still is crucified, that he underwent death. He fulfilled what he said he was going to do three times in chapters 8, 9, and 10 when he says that he would be crucified, and then Agartha, he rose. So he is not here. And then Itta Hatapas is a little bit unusual. Itta is actually an interjection. It's not an imperative, which would be itta. And tapas is in the nominative case because it's not the object of the itta. It's actually a new clause. So you'd have to translate this something like, look, exclamation point. The place where they put him is, so it's kind of two separate statements there. So the tomb is empty. The guy that went in dead came out alive. So what is the significance of this for the women and for the disciples? Allah ubagata aipata tois mathetaiso tu kaito petro. However, okay, what do you do now? Imperative upagata from upago, go aipata erase to his disciples and to Peter. I'll talk about that in a second. Hati prolage imas eston galalion eke auton apsista kathos aipen himin. So say to his disciples and Peter that he is going, present tense, before you, prohumas, into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he said to you. Now, this might sound a little strange, but the key clause in this entire pericope are the last three words of verse 7. Kathos eipen humin. Just as he said to you. What Mark is doing here in the ending of his narration is tying up the themes that have been developing through the Gospel of Mark. One theme, a key theme, is Jesus creating for himself a people who will undergo stress, persecution, and failure, but Jesus succeeds and accomplishes exactly what he says he is going to do. And so the message of Mark is that when the Christian faces trouble, distress, persecution, their confidence does not come from themselves, from their own ability to buck up under the pressure and stand steadfast or something like that. Confidence comes because Jesus does what he said he would do. So you see the reference to Peter there is, of course, a reference to Peter's denial a couple of chapters earlier, or a chapter earlier, in the courtyard of the chief priest, where he denied three times, just as Jesus said he was going to do. The going before you into Galilee is a reference to Jesus' statement at the Last Supper, that all the disciples would fall away. Yet, even though they fall away, Jesus would find them again in Galilee. And there you will see him. And seeing in the Gospel of Mark is the primary verb used to describe faith. So if you see, you understand. You have this reference in the parables chapter in chapter 4. It comes up again. So seeing is the understanding who Jesus is, having faith, recognizing him as Son of God, and placing all confidence and trust in him. So just as he said to you is a reminder that Jesus is faithful to his promises. And if you take a look back to chapter 11, verse 6, the beginning of the Jerusalem section, there's more on this all on the concordiatheology.org. We did a little video on the Gospel of Mark. But in 11, verse 6, the beginning of the Jerusalem section, you have the first time, kathos eipen ha Jesus autois, just as Jesus said. And this is where they find the donkey as he goes into Jerusalem. And what happens throughout Jerusalem, everything Jesus says is going to happen, happens. So they find a donkey. The fig tree doesn't produce any fruit. The disciples are sent to prepare for the Passover, and they found everything just as he said. The woman anoints Jesus for burial, and he dies. He gets buried. At the Passover, one of them will betray, and Judas does. You will all fall away. They all fall away in the garden. Peter will deny three times. He denies three times. The only thing that hasn't yet been fulfilled is Jesus appearing to his disciples in Galilee, and now we know that it will happen because everything Jesus said has happened. So the restoration of the disciples, and Peter in particular, is not found in their own confidence or strength, but in the promise of Jesus that he does his work for his people. So, verse 8. Kai exothusai ephagan apo to minimeu, eiken gar autas tramos kai ekstasis, kai udeni, uden, ipan, ephabunto gar. So our last feminine participle, having gone out, they fled. You can almost translate that, kept on fleeing from the tomb. So they're not following through, at this point anyway, on the command of the young man. And this next clause is a little grammatically strange. Tramos kai ekstasis, trembling and astonishment, fear and astonishment, are in the nominative case. So they're the subject of the verb. And even though there's two nouns as the subject, the verb is singular because they're collective here. So trembling and astonishment, eiken autas, had them. You might say kept on having, a durative idea here. And then the last clause, kai udeni uden, and they said uden, no thing, neuter accusative, udeni, to no one, dative masculine. So they said nothing to anyone, ephabunto gar, here the imperfect of phabeo, because they kept on being afraid. And that's where the narrative ends. Now, of course, there's a lot of discussion about what comes or should come or should not come afterward. It ends, I think, intentionally as a cliffhanger for this reason. Because the reader is in the same situation as the women. Will they trust in the promise, just as he said to you, and go tell the disciples? Well, we can assume that they did because the gospel got written down. The fact that the gospel exists is evidence of the fact that they did this. You don't need the rest of the narrative to tell you this. But the real importance of this is for the reader of the gospel. The women, we figure out by pondering this and thinking about it, actually fulfilled what they were supposed to do. They trusted in the promise. The question for the reader is this: do you also trust in the promise? Having come to the end of this gospel, heard this story of the Son of God come into the flesh to lay down his life as a ransom for many, to rise from the dead as a Son of God, do you place your trust in this man, in this Son of God, even though circumstances tell you that you shouldn't? Even though this man says that you will be persecuted, that you will suffer, that you will lose all things because of him, do you nonetheless, and face that fearfully, you know, but do you nonetheless put your confidence in this man to accomplish what he says he will do for you? Well, this is, of course, the good news of Easter. Jesus has accomplished what he said he would do by rising from the dead. And the good news of Easter is not only that this happened to Jesus, but also that it will happen to us. That we too will be renewed, restored, resurrected on the last day when he comes again, just as he said he would in Mark chapter 13. And we too live in hope, in spite of all the circumstances and situations that we face, that Jesus is faithful to his promises, and we can be confident in that. No matter what life throws at us, Jesus will keep his word. And that's the good news of Easter. We celebrate what has happened, but we also look forward to what will happen, that this will also happen for us. So enjoy the celebration of the day.